Patricia T. O'Connor is here, author of a number of books on the English language, Woe Is I, and the more recent Woe Is I Junior, also Words Fail Me, and You Send Me, and I'm sure there's another one in the works.
There is, yes.
And it's always a pleasure to see you, and we take calls when you're here at 646-778-3729. That's our new number, 646-778-3729. Often, Pat, when you come here, we get calls from people who say, you know, when I hear somebody mispronounce this word or that word, it sounds like chalk screeching on a blackboard.
Yeah, people aren't very tolerant about pronunciation. But as you know, one question we often get is why so many people say axe instead of ask. And as a matter of fact, not long ago, I got an email from a young woman living in London. And she was surprised at how many people there say axe instead of ask.
And British people.
British people. And
is this a new development?
No, not at all. Actually, I did some poking around in this. And contrary to popular opinion, this is not an inner city pronunciation necessarily.
Or an immigrant
pronunciation. Or an immigrant pronunciation, not limited to these groups. I know I heard it when I was growing up in Iowa from whites as well as blacks and Latinos. And believe it or not, Iowa is quite a diverse place. But
it is.
I was just reading a 19th century
it's
novel.
It's a terrible thing to us.
Cut that out. I was just reading a 19th century English novel by Henry Kingsley. And many of the Irish servants in that book say axe, A-X or A-X-E, instead of ask. And today this pronunciation is considered to be non-standard, but it wasn't always so. As a matter of fact, quite the reverse was true. When the noun or the verb that we think of as ask, to request something, when it first entered Old English in the 8th century, it had two forms. And in that back then, the infinitive forms ended in en or n, and the two forms of the verb were askian and axian, and the dominant one was axian. And during the Middle English period, it became even more dominant. And it turns out that simplified to ax, it was actually the preferred written form until about 1600.
So the question is, one of the reasons people say axe instead of ask is it's mm-hmm. easier to say axe.
It is.
So if it was easier to say and language tends toward that, mm-hmm. how did we
Why
wind
did
up with
change?
Ask? Why did we become axe murderers?
Instead of ask murderers. Well, you don't generally ask to be offed by somebody with a blunt instrument, but I don't actually know. I do know that in Chaucer, the verb is axe. In a 1535 translation of the Bible, axe and it shall be given you. He axed for writing tables, spelled with an X. Shakespeare actually used ask. He was on the cusp. In the early 1600s, the preferred form became ask, and I'm not sure why.
Because of Shakespeare, probably.
Could be.
He
determined... Maybe he was that influential. I don't know.
Well, he determined so much of our language. He really
only
invented words, but the language was kind of codified mm-hmm. by him, and the spelling
yeah,
as well
that's
at
true.
That time.
That's true. But though the spelling changed and the consonants sounds were switched in standard English, that old pronunciation still survives in some parts of England. And according to the OED, it can be heard everywhere in the Midlands and south of England. And it's also heard in the U.S., as we know.
So we've worked out axe and we'll never get upset again. But can you tell me, because there are certain mispronunciations that bother me, mm-hmm. although I never make a big thing about it. One that I hear from highly educated people is the word jewelry instead of jewelry.
Mm-hmm.
The dictionary.
Jewelry.
Yeah, many people, I think probably the majority of people I know, say jewelry.
Mm-hmm.
It's jewelry.
Right. Right.
Of course, I'm one of those weird ones who says February.
And you're the only person I know who says February. And I'm going to get a lot of email from people who say they're in your league, but...
Well, it just that's the way it's spelled, although I realize I don't say Wednesday. Wednesday.
Wednesday. Well, you know, there are a lot of consonant clusters in English that have been simplified over the centuries, including handkerchief. We don't say handkerchief. We say handkerchief.
Yeah.
So we've lost that D sound. We don't say the T in soften.
And we say forehead instead of forehead.
Right, right. And there are scores of examples of simplifications. And in the 19th century, a lot of people started re-insisting on the pronunciation often just because of the spelling, that the T was there, so we should start pronouncing it again. Actually, either way is considered acceptable.
When I hear often, I really, well, it makes me cringe. It sounds pretentious to me.
Do you often hear it?
I have heard it more than once. Just one other thing before we go to calls. I've been thinking about this for some odd reason, maybe because a number of people have been talking about weddings, and I thought, why is it that the words bridal and groom both refer to weddings and refer to horse things?
Oh, that's interesting. Well, I would guess that bridal...
of course, it's spelled differently with the horse.
And the horse may even come from different sources.
Well, bridal, actually, I think the A-L is ale. Comes from the word ale. It was the ceremony involved drinking an awful lot of ale. but groom is odd because it's the...
Groomsman, right.
You know, the...
Sure.
The married male is the groom, and then you primates groom each other, in fact, and then we groom before we go out.
We get out the curry comb and we groom ourselves.
Yeah, isn't that weird? Right. We groom the horse.
Yeah.
And there's all sorts of things. There are all sorts of grooms that are at the racetrack.
You know, okay, another word I want to talk about, though, before we start is an interesting development with subprime. It's been added to the OED.
When did it rate?
it rated last month in June. It was added to the OED, and it's an interesting word in one sense because when it started out, at least in the it began in the 1920s, just as a reference to anything that was below par, not quite up to standard, and it was used mainly for products. Subprime products were products in not very good condition.
So why didn't it make it into the OED until now, if it's been used since the 20s?
Good question. But I guess it wasn't important enough. It only began its banking career in the 90s, and at first, subprime was good. Subprime was a rate that was below interest rates that was given to very good creditworthy borrowers. So if you had a really stellar record, they'd give you a loan at below interest rates because they'd give you a subprime rate, and that was great. But in the later on, that was in the 70s. In the 90s, subprime became a negative thing because it meant not below market rate. It meant a high interest loan because the borrower was subprime. In other words, the borrower was not creditworthy.
This is what sometimes happens in the English language, like fulsome, for example.
Right.
Where it has one meaning initially and then it takes on an opposite meaning. Patricia T. O'Connor is with us, and we are taking your calls at 646-778-3729. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Should we go to some of the calls?
Yes.
Tom from Merrick, New York. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I wanted to mention a mispronunciation that really gets me riled. It's February doesn't bother me so much, and neither does often, but mischievous, which is not only a mispronunciation, but it's a outright mispronunciation. But because there's no I between after the V, I don't think.
No, it's a whole extra syllable.
Yeah, but I guess
and you will have to wonder why, because mischievous is perfectly fine, isn't it?
I think it's by analogy with devious. I think that people, they automatically add that syllable because of the word devious.
What did you want to talk about, Tom?
Oh, real people even make distinctions anymore with satire, farce, irony, wit, that kind of thing? Because they'll tell
not
you
what a New Yorker cover
exactly.
is involved.
Everyone's calling it sarcastic, farcical, you know, ironic. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, those things aren't alike, but I don't think anyone else.
How about horrifying? Does that word get included? So what do you think? Merged together?
Well, I don't think they've actually merged, but I think people use them interchangeably, which is too bad, especially in the case of irony. I would like to see that meaning preserved because it's such, I was going to say, such a unique word. It's a unique word. Nothing really replaces irony. Once it's gone, we can't, how do we say something's ironic? Something is ironic when it does the opposite of what you would expect or what was intended. And that's not satire. That's not farce. It's not lampooning. It's not burlesque. It's none of those things.
I want to talk about unique for a second.
Mm-hmm.
Because even very well-educated people screw up that word.
Mm-hmm.
And there are times when it's hard to avoid coming up with a modifier of unique.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you want to say totally unique or something
right.
like that.
Yeah, I'm conflicted about that because I can understand that the unique might be, if you take a similar word, perfect. You know, the founders talked about a more perfect union.
Mm.
What they meant was a union that's not perfect yet, but it's approaching perfection. It's closer to perfection than it used to be. And I think that it's also probably legitimate to talk about something that's maybe not quite unique,
but
it's
on
the way to being unique.
You could say almost unique, but people
right.
say it's the most unique thing in America.
Well, I think there can be degrees of uniqueness, but I don't like the adjective with it. So I have conflicting feelings about that, I suppose.
John from Bradley Beach, hi, you're on the air.
Thanks. I love this segment of the show. My question is the difference between country and nation, and I never would have thought of the difference, but recently Daniel Shore from NPR did a show on all the verbal gaffes that politicians make, and he insisted that they always say country when they should use nation. I think that's what he said.
Hmm.
Hmm. Well, I respect Daniel Shore a lot, and I'm sure that he has his head screwed on right. I would think that a country is the governmental entity, and that a nation is more of a not ethnic, but a spiritual.
That's
entity.
Why we have nationalism, not countryism.
Right. I don't. Is that the way Daniel Shore was using it?
You know, I honestly don't remember, and I'd have to go back and look up in NPR's archives. But I guess that's worth looking up because you hesitated in your answer. Again, it had never crossed my mind. But that's, you know, enough said there.
I think that we often use them interchangeably. There are times when probably one sounds better than the other. But
mm-hmm.
if you were to say the people of this nation, the people of this country, nobody is going to wonder whether you made a mistake.
And one other thing, I just wanted Patricia's opinion on the death, what I call the death of the adverb. If this has come up in a previous show, please indulge me and repeat yourself. But, you know, people say, drive safe, you know, things like that. They mean drive safely, the adverb. It's dying, and nobody cares. And should I just get over it because language is fluid?
I think you should get over it, but not because the adverb is dying. But people don't really understand adverbs, I think. Words like safe, slow, hard, fast, quick, those have all been legitimate adverbs for many, many centuries. The reason that we are focused so much on the ly part of the adverb is that during the 17th and 18th centuries, many Latinists were bothered because there was no inflectional ending in English officially differentiating an adjective from an adverb. And they felt that the ending leek, L-I-C-H, which is the old Saxon ending that means kind of like, that was appended to a lot of adjectives to make them adverbs. They felt that that ly ought to be added to a lot of existing what they thought were adjectives, but they were also adverbs too. So they came up with words like heavenly lee and jolly lee and friendly lee and put down a lot of where legitimately both a word could be both adverb and adjective, like slow, and where the adverb could legitimately have two forms, slow and slowly. They started discouraging the use of the flat adverb, the one without the ly. And so we focus too much on ly and think that when we say think fast, we should be saying think quickly or think quickly or turn right. We should be saying turn rightly or, you know, I'm exaggerating, but you get
the
drift.
In other words, the language is inconsistent.
Yes.
This is welcome to the English language.
Right.
Patricia T. O'Connor is our guest, and we're taking your calls at 646-778-3729. We will continue after this. We're back with Patricia T. O'Connor, author of Woe Is I, Words Fail Me, You Send Me, and Woe Is I, Junior. And we are taking your calls at 646-778-3729. And I hope this person will forgive me if I have mispronounced your name, Rizwan?
It is correct. This is Rizwan.
And what is your question, Rizwan?
Yeah, actually, I was trying to find the word blog in the dictionary. I couldn't find it.
Dictionaries sometimes have a hard time keeping up with technology words, but
right.
Blog comes from, it's actually a combination of words. It's a formation of web plus log. And it actually was first, its first incarnation was weblog. And then blog.
Oh, I got it.
Have you looked up subprime? That's now in the dictionary.
In the OED.
All right. Thank you, everybody. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Actually, you can tell in many cases just how new a word is by spell check.
Yes.
If spell check, it's interesting. Spell check will challenge blog, but it won't challenge Schwarzenegger.
Interesting. Huh.
Yeah. In fact, it's corrected me a number of times when I've spelt that wrong.
Right. It wants to capitalize Google, I know. If you use Google as a verb,
yes.
It wants to capitalize it.
Well, because Google is a brand name, isn't it?
I suppose, but that can't last.
Well, is that something that you like, that we take these brand names and we make, in this case, make it into a verb?
Oh, yeah. I don't think anyone should own the language. I mean, once a word becomes common, generic, I don't think that it belongs to anybody. Like the word realtor bothers me that not only do the realtors want to capitalize it, they want it to be all caps. I'm serious.
That's because they're making money hand over fist until recently. Marvin from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. On a prior program, you were discussing the term hunky-dory.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't believe you ever had a satisfactory explanation for the origin.
You know,
I can offer one.
Oh, go ahead.
I believe it comes from Japan. The word dori is a word for street or avenue in Japan. And near an American Navy base, there was a street called Honcho Dori. Now, that street had many, many bars, and that's where the sailors went for relaxation. And when they came back to the base, when people asked them, how's everything going, they'd say, everything is honcho dory, which then became hunky dory.
Did you email me about this?
No, I didn't.
No, okay, because your comments are identical to several emails that I got about this. And I researched this and found that that's probably not its origin. It probably comes from an old Dutch word, hunk, which was to stoop down or to be safe. Or like when children would play a game and they'd be playing, say, tag or home free. When they were home free, they'd be hunk. And eventually it became hunky, to be safe or to have arrived where you're going was to be hunky. And then probably Dory was added as a sort of rhyming. A lot of times a slang word would just add a rhyme to itself. So I know it's not quite as romantic as the Japanese red light district.
Well, the only way to find out for sure is to find out when it entered the language and if it entered before World War II.
Right. I should have brought along the information that I found about that. I'm just remembering it off the top of my head, but I think that's the thinking.
But isn't what he's suggesting what is called a back formation or something like that, where people work backwards and explain something?
Right.
And it makes sense.
Yeah, right. And a lot of things, a lot of etymological explanations come about that way, that people reason backwards to write what it must have meant. In fact, the whole nine yards, you know, it's no older than the space program. It first popped up in the mid-60s at NASA. It was a term used at NASA.
Wow. Michelle from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing? My question was about the word myriad, and it makes me kind of crazy because people often say a myriad of, and my understanding is that the word actually is defined as many thousands of. So if you say a myriad of, you're saying a many thousands of, which makes me nuts.
Right.
Is that true?
It used to make me nuts, too, because myriad, in my understanding, was just an adjective. So you'd say we have myriad this or myriad that, rather than a myriad of, which would be using it as a noun.
Uh-huh.
But it turns out I'm wrong.
Oh.
And I think it's because it's evolved, because that's the way people have used it. Actually, here we go. I'm finding a usage note here in American Heritage Dictionary.
Uh-huh.
It's a noun meaning a vast number. It says throughout most of its history in English, myriad was used as a noun. In the 19th century, it began being used in poetry as an adjective, as in myriad men. So we were hearing it used poetically as an adjective, and I, among others, started believing that, well, that's the correct way. But in fact, they're both right. So there you go.
So if people now say a myriad of, you shouldn't go off the handle at them.
No.
You shouldn't anyway. You should just simply... If they say something totally incorrectly, you just simply note it to yourself and say, well, I'll never do that again. Or you write to the newspaper and say, when did your standards get so low? But that's a whole other thing.
That's the gracious way of going at it. I used to be an editor, so I would always make big red marks, but I stand corrected.
I just saw something in Time magazine where they said that this new HBO series about the Iraq War was based on the writings of Evan Ross. Well, it's not Evan Ross. It's Evan Wright, I know, because I interviewed the director of many of the films, but also because I think Evan Wright was here at one point. And I have been playing, I never send these letters, but I've been playing with sending a little note to the Time magazine and say, do you ever get anything right, W-R-I-G-H-T? these mistakes occur all the time. We just have to let them go, don't we?
It's true.
And I hope you forgive me because I make mistakes all the time. It's talking off the top of my head.
But your knowledge is rather, you know, broad, so you can get away with it a lot.
Well, thank you so much for being so tolerant. And we go now to Ron from, where are you from? Creskill?
Creskill.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
We're okay.
Good. My question is, why do we say attorney at law instead of law? Shouldn't that be the correct way to say that?
Well, why not just attorney, right? Isn't a lawyer
true,
an attorney?
But, you know, like somebody gets a PhD in psychology, is a doctor of psychology, not at it.
Good point. I never thought about that. But
there
are so many.
This question, by the way, I've asked dozens of attorneys, and you know, a lot of English speakers. English is my second language. And
what's your first?
Spanish.
Really?
Yes.
Huh.
So nobody can seem to answer this question, so I'm glad I got through to you. But
you know, maybe it's just one of those legal pomposities.
Could be.
Because, you know, they say things like, party of the first part and whatnot, instead of just the first party.
Yes.
And other things. And
another reason people hate lawyers.
At the bar. He's practicing at the bar. Why not just he's practicing law?
Yeah.
So maybe attorney at law is just another one of those. Although now I can get all the lawyers are picking up their phones right now.
I hope so because
no, they're all at the bar right now.
No attorney can give me an answer to this. And I know quite a few.
Thank you so much for calling us. Maybe somebody will clear that up. Catherine from Manhattan.
Thank you to both of you, and you know, understatement to say that we love your use of language, Leonard, and with that, your pronunciation. I think there may be a misstep in a word that you use from time to time, and a word that I love your using, and it's the word imprimatur, which I think takes the accent on the ma, like you were calling your mother, rather than the pr. You know, as a former nun and ex-Catholic, it's a word Catholics, you know, use in that, you know, instrument.
I say imprimatur.
Yeah. What do you think, Patricia?
So
the dictionary tells me imprimatur rather than.
Well, if the dictionary tells you imprimatur, then that's what we should go
keep
with.
Keep using it.
I'm sure that they're both correct, but actually, I'm looking.
Okay.
Okay, I
are
get.
Are you being nice to your friend and
imprimatur?
And impulsive, Patricia.
No, wait a minute. You know what? I find two pronunciations in here, but in both of them, the accent is on the ma.
Okay.
Imprimatur,
yeah,
and imprimatur.
I think that's it. Keep using it, though, Leonard. I love it. But maybe change it.
I'll try to pronounce it imprimatur.
I always said
from now on.
Exactly. Thank you very much. Love, love, love everything about what's going on. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. In some cases, it's because you actually have learned a word from reading it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And there are any number of words that you... I've been afraid to use over the years because
right.
I wasn't sure how to pronounce
right,
them.
Right,
And I promised myself I would look them up in the dictionary and then haven't. One word that I found really interesting that I was very snobby about, I always thought that the word should be pronounced Judaism because mm-hmm. that's the way it's written.
Uh-huh.
And that Judaism was really about some woman named Judy. But the dictionary says it's Judaism.
Ah. Okay.
Without a Judaism as an alternate choice. Yeah,
mm.
but it's like they didn't give me imprimatur. It's either imprimatur or imprimator.
Yeah, imprimator. Oh, well.
That.
It's like that Monty Python routine where it's spelled cholmondeley, but it's pronounced throat warbler mangrove.
Yes. Yes. Well, the British do have a lot of words like that. Bill from Montclair. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. A few weeks ago, Paul Krugman had a column, and he described Barack Obama as a transformational politician. That same morning, Brian Lehrer had a guest on, and he summarized what Paul Krugman said by describing Barack Obama as a transformative politician.
Hmm.
I think this campaign season, dozens of times, I have seen Barack described as transformative and transformational.
Hmm.
Forget whether or not he's either. Is there a difference, and should we care?
I always thought he was a Democrat.
Well, it seems to me that if you're transformative, you've transformed yourself. But if you're transformational, you're transforming other things. But I don't know why I think that. One seems to be self-directed, and one seems to be outward-directed.
And he may be both.
He may be both.
Thank you for your call. I'm sure somebody will call in and correct us, as Dill has. Dill from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, I need to correct you on my name. That's Bill, actually.
I said Dill, didn't I?
No, Bill.
Bill. Oh, it was written. It was written here.
That's
it's
okay.
D-I-L-L.
No, it's B-I-L, but that's okay. But what's
you're
not
in a pickle,
okay,
Leonard.
What's not okay is that even journalists all use the words government, country, and nation interchangeably, and they have different meanings, and you got it slightly wrong. The governmental entity, as you put it, is the government. The country refers to the land, as should be obvious, as in countryside. And the nation refers to the people who live on the land who are united by a common language and culture.
And there it is. Thank you so much.
That sounds pretty authoritative.
And it sounds correct as well. Thank you so much, Bill. Matthew from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon.
Yes, what do you want to talk about?
I was wondering about how our educated East Coast dialect has changed, especially after World War II. And I've noticed that before World War II, people talked a lot like Bill Buckley or, FDR with that sort of, very British pronunciation. And then somehow in the 1950s, that all changed. And, East Coast educated, dialect became sort of an R pronouncing, more similar to standard American. And I've noticed now that there's like a subset of that. There's almost like, I call it like an NPR educated dialect, where there's a lot of emphasis on the vowel pronunciation of A. So instead of saying something like last, it's almost like lost. You know what I'm talking about? Where does this come from? It's not standard American. It's a little different.
I'm not a phonologist. I think I have an idea what you're talking about, though. I don't think of it as something that came from East Coast intellectuals. I remember it from movies of the 40s and 50s.
When sound came in, everyone spoke very correctly, perhaps because they were afraid that it would get blurred.
Yes, yes. And also, I think a lot of them were theatrically trained. But also, when you had movies about, I think of them as Philadelphia mainline type characters, Katharine Hepburn, Grace Kelly, they all seemed to have a certain kind of, almost bordering on a Cary Grant kind of accent.
We have run out of time. You'll be back on the 27th. If people want to reach you while you're away, Grammar, what is it?
Mailbox
at grammarphobia.com.
Right.
Thank you so much, Patricia T. O'Connor. Look forward to seeing you again and reading all of your books through once more.